Thank you, Your Honor. As the court notes, I represent BPL Medical and Jason Cardiff, who will refer to collectively as BPL. BPL appealed a preliminary injunction. Oh, before I forget, I want to reserve 5 minutes for a rebuttal and 10 minutes for my primary argument, if that's acceptable.
It's fine. You'll have to watch the clock yourself, but I'll try to help you.
Yes, sir. Thank you. BPL appealed a preliminary injunction imposing a receivership over the company. This is a company that manufactures made in USA 3-ply surgical quality masks that can be fit for both adults and children. BPL was not a party in the original lawsuit between Redwood Scientific and the FTC. BPL Redwood distributed and sold health supplements, whereas
Mr. Cachell, can I ask you a preliminary question?
Yes, sir.
I can't tell from the briefing. I think I know the answer. Are you today attacking both preliminary injunctions or only the second one?
The second.
So you're not today challenging the initial preliminary injunction that applies to Cardiff, if you
yes.
will.
Yes. I mean, so the first injunction in the receivership was imposed over Jason Cardiff and his wife. It applies. And then 18 months after the initial receivership order was entered over Redwood, the FTC then sought to impose receivership over BPL. We opposed, the TRO was entered ex parte. We filed a motion to dissolve the TRO, which the court denied. We cited Liu as part of our reasoning. Then subsequently, the preliminary injunction was entered in the case over VPL and Jason Cardiff. We subsequently filed a motion to remove the receiver for inaction because the receivership was imposed just as the company was ramping up manufacturing operations to comply with a 20 million face mask contract with the Department of Health and Human Services. We argued at that time that the public interest did not favor a receivership and that the original reasons, concern of dissipation of assets, we opposed that and said the assets are all there. They're, you know, as to Cardiff, they were down the street in a bank, which was easily identified. And
if the first preliminary injunction is not challenged, then, you know, if we were to find that VPL fell within the terms of that, even without considering whether or not there's an additional source from the second preliminary injunction, then that would be dispositive, wouldn't it?
I don't think so. I would respectfully take issue with that. The reason being, first off, the order is very, the actual order over VPL was very consistent with SEC versus Liu. The Redwood receivership order is consistent because it limited assets only existing at the time of the TRO, the preliminary.
But that's not right. It's in three categories on the asset freeze, and the third one doesn't have a temporal limitation, and that's the one the district court invoked here, right?
And that's what the district court held. We would respectfully submit that the third category is limited because of the way it's phrased, you know, that it's owned or controlled directly or indirectly by Cardiff. Assets, and then it identified assets that were known at the time. So that was a general catch-all, so that if the FTC found assets that were not known at the time but existed, that would be well within the framework of that order. Otherwise, it's just the phrasing of it, having it, you know,
wouldn't your reading make the third category just superfluous? Because the first one says all assets of all defendants at the time it was entered. The second then says all assets obtained by defendants after the TRO was entered, if they're derived. And then the third one just says all assets owned or controlled directly or indirectly by Cardiff. If the first two operate in the way, if the third one operates in the way you say, it's duplicative of the other two, isn't it?
I think it's a catch-all to identify assets that haven't been identified. They went out of their way to identify these trusts. But
oh, it doesn't say anything about identified in the first two. It just says all assets at the time and then all assets after. And if three has a temporal limitation, it seems to me to the words are meaningless. They don't add a single thing. Tell me what they add if your reading is right.
Well, I think what they add is in the past tense, referring to assets that exist at the time of the injunction. And it must be read in relationship to the second provision that talks about how it's related to the subject matter of the complaint. So the court
But don't we have, I'm sorry, finish, problem with Zoom. So finish what you were saying. I wanted to ask you a question about that topic.
Right. So it's very much like reading a contract that you have to read it as a whole. And so when you read these three provisions as a whole, they're talking about, particularly the second provision talks about assets that were derived from the subject matter of the lawsuit, which is totally consistent with Lew, which gets back to your original question, is this completely dispositive? We don't think it is, because Lew makes it clear that courts cannot simply enter orders requiring, allowing seizure of assets that are not related to the subject matter of the underlying lawsuit.
Okay, before we get to Lew, here's my question for you.
Yes, sir.
If you're not attacking the first injunction and the third clause that Judge Collins just read to you, you read as only relating to assets already identified or something like that. But the judge in the second injunction said, let me make it clear, what I meant the first time was precisely what we're talking about today. And there's a lot of case law that says judges can clarify their injunctions. Now, that injunction may be overbroad. It may be right. Something you could have attacked.
Right.
But if you're not doing it, and that's the way the judge interprets the third clause of the first injunction, how can you get around that?
Well, I suppose in the broad sense, we are attacking the injunction based on Lew.
Well, that's why I asked.
Yeah, so no, I understand.
You didn't appeal the first injunction, did you?
I don't, off the top of my head, recall. I think
that's not the appeal in front of us today, anyway.
Right.
The appeal in front of us today is from the second one.
That I believe is accurate, Your Honor. So, interpreting an order in this case, that doctrine on a cases doesn't strictly speaking apply because Judge G was not the judge who entered this particular order. Judge Otero entered it, and then he, left the bench. So this is basically Judge G is coming into this cold, and so this is an order that was drafted by the government and presented. It has all the elements that you would think, consider if you were construing a contract, which, while it's not a contract, certainly it's a document that has to be construed in light of the law, the background of the law, which is SEC versus Lew, as it then existed. And if it's overly broad, then it's overly broad. So we would
receive. What relief are you seeking here today?
I'm asking for the preliminary injunction over VPL to be dissolved. The preliminary injunction be reversed and the receivership over VPL be dissolved. And then, the remainder of the case stays in force until we, have an appeal on the merits.
I know you wanted to save some time. I'm sorry, go ahead, Judge Seiler.
I just want to say, do you want it to be sent back on a hearing concerning the Lew case, or you're not ready?
Well, we think Lew is dispositive. It is very clear that none of the assets from Redwood were used to finance or to operate VPL. None of the there's no allegation of unlawfulness or a joint enterprise with Redwood, and BPL? Obviously not, because it was created 18 months after the fact. So what connection is there? Can a district court simply, based on a court order, freeze and seize assets that are totally unrelated to the subject matter of the lawsuit? And we respectfully submit that under SEC versus Liu, there's two major holdings.
I'm a little confused by that, because I thought the argument was that the application of SEC versus Liu would sufficiently limit the amount of money that was at stake in the underlying claims, thereby secondarily affect the ability to freeze assets in a particular amount to satisfy the expected judgment. Now you seem to be saying that Liu applies directly to freezing orders, and I didn't perceive to be your argument.
Well, I think your understanding is correct, but I think, you know, the FTC takes the position that the Liu didn't apply to freeze orders. But as a matter of logic and common sense, if the court cannot seize or enter a judgment based on anything other than unlawful net profits or ill-gotten gains in the underlying case, it logically, they cannot go out and simply freeze any asset that
may have. Why is that so? Now put aside for a second how AMG turns out and whether Liu is been over, you know, whether Liu overrules previous Ninth Circuit law. Why can't the FTC, when it finds conduct violating the Federal Trade Act, get an injunction so that the people that were harmed can later seek damages or restitution from the agency, even if it can't?
Well, there's nothing in the statute that allows that. There's nothing in the law of equitable restitution that allows that. So if they proceed on Section 13B and seek equitable restitution, which in every case they do, they are limited by the confines of equitable restitution. They can't go above and beyond it. So it may be that in a case they'll inadvertently seize property that's untainted or unrelated to the fraud, but once the receiver gets in or once the FTC determines that the property is not tainted or is not related to the subject matter of the case, it has an obligation to release that, because they always have the option to proceed in an ultimate judgment against assets owned by the individual. And so that's a fight that remains for another day.
I really want to be clear about what your position is, because I thought you clarified it, and now I'm confused by what you said.
Sorry.
Are you saying that Liu applies directly to freezing orders and limits what can go into an asset freezing order? Or are you just saying that Liu limits the ultimate underlying relief in the case, and that those limits, by limiting the amount of money, then put a cap or put limits on what can be frozen to satisfy that? Do you see the difference between those two positions?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. I think it's a two-pronged issue. One, Liu limits the amount of restitution that can be gained from someone's assets, limiting it to ill-gotten gains and unlawful profits. But as a corollary to that, the second part of it, the principles in Liu, it's not a direct holding, but the principles in Liu logically and inescapably lead to the conclusion that the government can only get a judgment against the assets that are related to the underlying fraud. They cannot seize assets as a pre-judgment writ of attachment, which is a completely different animal and is not a creature of equity.
And we've taken you, Judge, go ahead, Judge Collins. I just want to say, well, don't worry about your time. I'll give you a minute or two for rebuttal. So please answer Judge Collins's questions.
Thank you.
So you're saying that even if under Liu, just use a hypothetical, a defendant would likely be subject to a $5 million judgment and had assets of $5 million, but none of them could, that of the assets that were currently in the possession of the defendant, could be tied to the specific wrongful conduct because there'd been so much going on. You're saying that they couldn't freeze any of that in satisfaction of that judgment?
Yes, that's what the principles of equitable restitution hold and what I think the law requires.
Okay. So I wanted to ask you one other question, and that's this. You're assuming that Lew applies to the Federal Trade Act, and that may be a good argument, but isn't that essentially what's in front of the Supreme Court in AMG?
No. Lew does apply.
It's not. You may say that, and that's a good argument, but it doesn't apply on its face. It interprets the Securities Exchange Act, correct?
It interprets a provision of the SEC, and it talks in very broad, sweeping language.
No, I understand, but the Federal Trade Act has somewhat different language. It may be less broad than the SEC Act. I don't know, but it seems to me the issue in front of the court in AMG is how to interpret the language in the Federal Trade Act, and I have no idea what they're going to say, which is always true with the Supreme Court. So my question is, wouldn't we be wise to wait for them to see what they say about the scope of the Federal Trade Act provision with respect to remedy?
Well, I would ordinarily counsel prudence and defer to the court's thought process. But in this case, we have a receivership where face masks, protective face masks, and the increasing death toll among Americans and the need for made in USA face masks, I think, gives this case an additional sense of urgency that would not otherwise exist. We have a company that's making 75,000 face masks a day, a rate of 1.5 million a month, and the national stockpile is depleted, and the schools urgently need children's face masks. We would respectfully submit that there is some urgency here to address the issue so that there's greater flexibility to expand this factory without going through a very lengthy receivership process of due diligence and triple checking.
Okay, I think you've answered my question, and yes, I appreciate it. I'll give you a couple of minutes for rebuttal because we took you over.
Thank you.
Let's hear from the commission.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. I'm Mark Hegedus for the Federal Trade Commission. This case concerns what this court has characterized in its affordable media decision as the great public interest in preserving assets for possible equitable relief. And here, $5 million worth of assets are frozen and subject to the receivership, but CARTA's potential liability for defrauding consumers exceeds $18 million.
What's your view on Judge Hurwitz's question about AMG? I mean, if the Supreme Court rules that this kind of relief isn't available under Section 13, does that just cut the legs out from under this injunction?
Your Honor, it really does depend on what the Supreme Court ultimately rules, but in terms of the way the law stands...
A hypothetical would say, suppose that they rule that Section 13, the FTC loses in its argument on the scope of Section 13, and they hold that it does not extend to this type of monetary relief. Does that mean that this injunction falls?
Again, Your Honor, we'll have to see what the specific language is. We would ask, though, that the court go ahead.
You don't get to rewrite the hypothetical. He just gave you the specific language. Right. The specific language is that Section 13 does not allow for restitution relief in a suit by the FTC. That's the opinion of the Supreme Court. Does it affect this injunction?
Your Honor, if there's no ability to get any kind of equitable relief, and the point of the injunction was to preserve assets for that equitable relief, then yes, I would have to agree with that. But I would like to just point out that the district court should have the opportunity to rule in the first instance about what...
We might vacate and remand and send it back to the district court. We're just trying to figure out, as a prudent matter, whether or not the validity of the injunction may turn in part about how the Supreme Court rules. And I think what you're saying to us is that it's at least conceivable that the Supreme Court's ruling could affect the scope and validity of the injunction. Is that a fair statement?
Yes, it is, Your Honor. And in addition, though, that the
have you invoked Section 19 in this? And I didn't see it in the complaint in this case. Would that be a safety net for any part of this, or is that not on the table?
We have not invoked Section 19 in this, Your Honor. The district court, though, I would like to point out, has a procedure already set up. The district court has granted summary judgment on liability in favor of the FTC, but it has reserved ruling on remedy based upon the decision that is handed down in AMG. So with respect to disposing of this case now, in the current law, this court can dispose of this case and reject the appeal and then allow the district court to rule in the first instance about how AMG should be applied based upon the fact record that has been established before the district court. To address one other issue that you asked Mr. Cardiff about, Mr. Cardiff did not appeal the original PI in this case.
Right.
And that original PI is clear that it reaches Cardiff's assets whenever acquired. When the district court entered that PI, it was aware of Cardiff's track record of lying about, concealing, and transferring his assets, as well as his defiance of court orders. And it cited that record in entering that PI. And it was for that reason that the FTC proposed and the district court adopted this PI that reaches Cardiff's assets whenever they are acquired, because we don't have an assurance that in new businesses that Mr. Cardiff may start, that there aren't assets coming from some of the illegal activity. Mr. Cardiff has refused to come clean with respect to his asset disclosures. He's been found in contempt on a number of occasions for that reason. And so it was certainly prudent and reasonable for the district court to enter a PI that extends to his current assets as a prudent measure to help ensure that there would be money available to provide equitable relief if at the end of the day, Mr. Cardiff were found liable.
I have a question.
Yes, Your Honor.
Is it your position that even after the seizure of these assets that Cardiff has sufficient assets to proceed under this, under whatever his business is, making these masks or other things? Or have all of his assets been seized?
Your Honor, all of his assets are subject to the freeze, but the receiver is working with Mr. Cardiff and with Mr. Betty to try to help VP&L be a profitable and lawful enterprise. Mr. Cardiff, in fact, is being paid along with Mr. Betty to operate VP&L. The receiver has authorized a release of funds so that VP&L can do the necessary upgrades to its facilities to produce these masks. And so the ability for the business to continue to make masks is there. So the receivership is not impeding that. With respect to the assets that are under that are frozen, I would like to point out that Lou, even if it does apply, and if we can assume that it applies, doesn't change the ability of the FTC to reach Mr. Cardiff's assets whenever acquired. And the reason for that is Lou has not changed, did not impose a tracing requirement for assets. What Lou addressed was the amount that may be reached to provide equitable relief at the end of a case.
But he's arguing that if Lou is applied, at least one of his arguments is that if Lou is applied, the amount at stake is going to drop sufficiently that that will implicate how much you can freeze. And so that means that it matters whether Lou applies to the, not just the tracing part of Lou, but, you know, his arguments that Lou requires considering expenses and that therefore the amount of restitution will go down. What's your response to that?
Your Honor, Lou is satisfied in this case for the following reasons. The FTC has determined and the district court also found that the potential equitable relief here is $18.2 million. Now, Lou says that the amount that is used to provide equitable can't exceed net profits. So that means you need to deduct legitimate expenses from that amount. Mr. Cardiff and the defendants here have not come forward with legitimate expenses that could be deducted from that $18.2 million amount. And so what we have here is potential liability of $18.2 million and frozen assets totaling some $5 million. So
you're arguing that you would win even within lieu.
That's right, Your Honor.
I want some clarification on that. As I read Mr. Cochell's brief, he says the district court refused to consider his claim of legitimate expenses. I'm not sure I can find that in the record, but I want to ask you to address that.
Yes, Your Honor. So Mr. Cardiff and the defendants argued lieu on a number of occasions, but in each one, they never actually came forward with any numbers to prove that any of the expenses were legitimate. The only thing that they pointed to was the receiver's conclusions that that the Redwood Scientific business was a money-losing enterprise.
Did the district court ever make a determination as to who was right under, you know, lieu, if you were applying that standard, we had to consider legitimate expenses? Did the district court determine who was right and whether the evidence had been met?
Not in so many words, Your Honor. The district court did discuss in the VPL PI order the $18.2 million and the amount that had been frozen. But the district court did not specifically address the existence of legitimate expenses. But the
sounds like if lieu applies, we have to send this back to be reconsidered so that that can be resolved.
Your Honor, you could do that, absolutely. And then at that point, the district court could make a ruling based upon the existing record. There is a full record in this case. The case has gone, has summary judgment has been decided here. And so the district court could make a ruling about whether or not there has been a showing regarding legitimate expenses. We believe, though, that the record shows that there has been no showing that there are legitimate expenses in this case. There has been no...
Can you help us out with respect to the status in the district court? I know there's a summary judgment on liability. Is there a trial scheduled on remedy? Is there a schedule?
The schedule is that once the AMG decision is issued, then the parties need to do a joint status report to address further proceedings. The FTC expectation is that there will not be a need for additional proceedings in terms of development of the record, that the record is sufficient to apply whatever the AMG ruling is to this case. But based upon what the AMG decision ultimately is, the parties will work with the district court judge to determine what the subsequent proceedings will look like.
So do you also contend still that lieu doesn't apply at all?
Your Honor, that is our principal contention, but for purposes of resolving this case, this court does not need to reach that issue because of the fact that the standards of lieu are satisfied here. The amount to be possibly paid in restitution is above $18 million. The amount frozen is less than $5 million. And the defendants here have not come forward to show legitimate expenses that could reduce that $18.2 million figure. So the Court of Appeals here could affirm the district court on that basis alone.
But that only if we were to take on in the first instance the work the district court hasn't done in resolving that. I mean, normally that would be something we'd send back, and normally we would instead decide the issue whether lieu applies in the first place. So tell me why it in your view, it doesn't apply.
Your Honors, you could actually make that determination just based upon this record. I mean, even in this record, the defendants here have been able to could come forward and show what the legitimate expenses are. But if you examine their briefs, if you look at the record, there are no citations by the Cardiffs to any legitimate expenses. The only claim that they make with respect to lieu is that the Redwood Scientific Enterprise lost money. But what we do know from the record and it is discussed even in the district court decisions, is that the Redwood Scientific Enterprise spent millions of dollars on advertising and media to try to sell their fraudulent products to consumers. It spent about $3.2 million to acquire these products to sell to consumers. We now know that that was a fraudulent enterprise. And so those expenses cannot be legitimate expenses under lieu. So this court certainly could rule, even based upon this record, that lieu is not satisfied here. Lieu, in fact, is satisfied, that the amount that has been frozen is far less than the amount of potential equitable monetary relief that would be ordered at the end of the case.
Well, but going back to the threshold question, I mean, given that in Commerce Planet, we analogize the scope of the equitable relief available to that brought in disgorgement actions by the SEC, why wouldn't the limits in lieu apply to the FTC as well, assuming AMG doesn't go even further and take the whole thing off the table?
I'm sorry, Your Honor. So right at the end of your question, there was some interference, so I didn't hear the last part of your question.
So I was asking, given that we analogized in Commerce Planet the FTC's disgorgement restitution authority to that in SEC actions, then why wouldn't lieu's limitations then apply to FTC cases?
I have two prongs to my response, Your Honor. First of all, if lieu does apply, we still should win here. But secondly, in Commerce Planet, this court actually recognized that the use of the term injunction in the FTC Act implies a broader scope of relief than is available under the SEC, Securities Exchange Act, with its use of the term equitable relief.
That broader scope is defined by Porter, which is, of course, what lieu relied on in imposing the limits it did. It cited Porter as well. So I don't, that doesn't seem to work.
Well, we believe that the fact that the Supreme Court cited to Porter affirmatively in lieu suggests that the view that this court took in Commerce Planet remains valid. But we'll know soon enough, you know, what this all means for the FTC Act once the AMG ruling comes down. And the district court has already set up a mechanism to make a determination as to how AMG applies at the end of once that decision comes down. Your Honors, I see my time is up. I'm happy to answer further questions.
Let me see if either of my colleagues have other questions. No, if not, we'll put a couple of minutes on the clock for Mr. Kitchell.
Okay, thank you, Your Honors.
Yes, a couple of quick issues. Council raised the issue of the Section 7 asset freeze provision. The issue was first framed as whether didn't the third provision, override the first two provisions. And I think we could also perhaps take a different view and say, if the third provision has no temporal limitation, then what is the point of the first two provisions, which do limit the scope of the asset freeze? So
difference is that they apply to all defendants and the third one doesn't. So Cardiff was singled out for special treatment.
Well, we would respectfully take issue with the court on that, but I understand the court's point. The other counsel said that the receiver is not impairing VPL. We didn't even start manufacturing operations for 5 months because of delays and mistakes by the receiver, some of which are
I wanted to ask you about that. That's a separate issue from your arguments about the limits of restitution, is it not?
It is.
In other words, on this issue, you made those arguments to the district court. The district court didn't buy them. Right. We review that for abuse of discretion.
Right. It is certainly, again, it gets down to, the public interest. I recognize that overruling a preliminary injunction on the public interest factor is rare, if ever, rarely if ever done. But this is one of those cases where there's a national emergency where we think that there should have been some greater consideration and a different modification of it. We do believe that when you talk about related versus unrelated to the subject matter of the case, there has to be tracing. Otherwise, how do you determine what's related? Secondly, we think that the injunction in Redwood is tied directly to VPL, but for the Redwood injunction, there could be no injunction in VPL. Therefore, while it's not directly appealed, we think it's squarely in the mix, which is why we've raised it. There was no, I think the receiver's report is incredibly strong evidence with a very lengthy analysis of the assets, and they said no net profits. And
we've taken you over and you've taken us over, so we're even. I want to thank both sides for their arguments and briefing in this case, and this case will be submitted.
Thank you.